going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, Danny? How are you?
Chilling, man, as per usual. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good.
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
I heard we're going to do an update, like podcast. Like this whole podcast is going to be about like updates and random shit like that. Is that true?
On today's episode?
Yeah.
I guess you could say that. I don't know if updates is the right way to. You make it sound like it's a computer upgrade. But yeah, I guess you could say that we're following up on some things that we've talked about in some other shows previously. I guess the first most important thing is the Britney Spears situation, right?
Oh, Britney. Hashtag free Britney. Seriously.
But apparently, I guess you can explain the story real quick, right? A quick rundown. Her father was saying that she wasn't competent to manage her money.
So like for a number of years, I forget exactly how many, Britney Spears' father has been basically running her life and her finances and her everything. Like he's been able to convince a judge that Britney is like gone off the deep end. She's not mentally stable. And that she cannot, you know, handle herself, and therefore she needs what I believe is called a conservatorship, and that's what her father does for her. Her father and like the lawyer or something like that. And so they manage her money, they manage her time, they tell her what she can, where she can go, who she can see, you know, the whole nine yards, right? Total crazy story. Now, on one hand, you might be saying, "Hey, didn't like Britney have a breakdown one day and like shaved her head and like went nuts?" Yes, you're correct. But also, when you look at it in the other direction, they've been saying that she is disabled, in effect disabled, right? She's mentally incapable of doing, you know, anything. Yet she's dropped several albums, done several tours, has been working in, you know, in Nevada, in Las Vegas, doing shows for many years. So either she's mentally incapable and her family, her father and the lawyer are whoring her out to make money, or she is capable and they're just lying that she's mentally incapable so that they can take her money. Either way, they're taking her money.
and now the update is that the sister is taking control of her finances, right?
Jamie Lynn. Well, I didn't know this. So did she actually get this done, or is she just attempting to do it?
I'll be honest, I just saw the headline, didn't read the story, and assumed that you read it.
I didn't actually see that one yet.
Jamie Lynn, the girl who got pregnant when who was on Nickelodeon, and then he got pregnant and fired.
Yeah, that wasn't cool. Yeah. But right. No, that's interesting. All I can say is that I don't think Britney needs a conservatorship. I think she needs to be free and do her own thing. And if she is totally nutso and she is mentally incapable of taking care of herself, then it'll work itself out. Like either she'll like go nuts on someone and end up in jail, or, you know, in a mental institution, or we'll find out that she's not mentally incapable, and, you know, then she'll be fine and free and to herself. I don't see why we have to take her liberties away. I don't see why.
I can't argue with that. All right, before we make people vomit on this show and turn away, let's get to the actual topics. So I don't know where to start. So maybe we could just start with obviously, you know, we could go down a rabbit hole with the RNC convention, and maybe we'll have some time to voice some opinions at the end of the show. But let's start with this vehicle collision in Syria, because I think it can segue into the rest of the stuff. But
yep,
what was interesting is that we've been talking about Syria for the past 2 years. It was one of the first topics we've really talked about. And this week mm-hmm. there was a U.S. Russian car accident or vehicle collision. And this happened up in northwestern Syria. And I don't know, did you see the video of this?
I did, but I actually only saw the short version. I didn't see the whole thing. But yeah, I mean, I think I'll let you say your piece before I jump in.
Well, I saw the video of it, mm-hmm. and it honestly just looked like an accident. But
yeah,
my piece is that it just looked like kind of like a side swipe. The good thing is no one died. I think some U.S. Troops.
Yeah, they were apparently suffering like concussion-like symptoms, you know, or at least that's what I read on the American side, and I haven't really heard of any injuries on the Russian side.
Yeah, but if you look at the vehicle, it's just like it's a side swipe. Mm-hmm. It looked like a kind of a standard car accident, but I guess it's a vehicle collision. So I wasn't exactly sure what the vehicles were. They both looked like armored vehicles that hit each other. However, no one died, which is good. But this is the consequence of having such a crowded battlefield, and I think that's the first thing that everyone should jump. And that's the first conclusion to be made. Over in Syria, you know, how many armies can you count?
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty crowded.
That are currently in that country. So we mm-hmm. have the United States, Russia, the Syrian Arab Army. You have the SDF, the Kurds. You have Iraqi militias. You have the actual rebels who are now. You have the moderate rebels.
Moderate rebels.
You have Hezbollah. You have Iran.
Yeah,
so
just...
we're talking about.
Everybody's
such
there. It's a big party.
A crowded battlefield, mm-hmm. and then you have Israel coming in every once in a while dropping bombs. It's just accidents like this are going to happen, and you know the way that it's just weird how the media always plays it, and how you know Trump. I don't think has made any statement on it yet, and the media is already being like, "Well, prove it." Pumping up Putin won't even stand up for our guys who get into a fender bender with like.
Well, I mean, stuff. Like, so I just pulled up this longer video and I left it running in it. So the going narrative that I kept hearing was that from like the pro-Russia side was that the American vehicles were blocking the path, and therefore they had to like, they were trying to get around them, and then they couldn't. It's kind of like when you're in a, you know, in a car and you're on the highway and, you know, someone's like right up your ass. And you know, you try to get over to the side or something like that to be respectful and let them go through, but some people aren't respectful and they'll just like speed up when you try to get around them, you know. So like that's what I feel like just looking at this video right now. It looked like the Russian vehicle, the Russian MRAP, was trying to get around this American vehicle, and as he went to go to overtake him and get around him, the American vehicle that does appear to be speeding up. It looks literally like any car accident you would see on the road. But reading it, you know, reading the headlines on, you know, the mainstream media, it'll have you tell you that Russia's aggressive towards us in Syria and that we should probably do something about it.
Yeah, it's quite a silly narrative. But it's like every single time something like this happens where, you know, you hear about an American dying, if you can recall, about 6 months ago, some U.S. soldiers died in a vehicle that was due to an explosion from ISIS. You're just kind of left with like, why? Wait, Trump said he was pulling these guys out.
Right. Why are they still there?
But then it doesn't take too long to remember, like, oh yeah, because there was this whole political theater thing going on with the Kurds. Like,
right.
You can't pull all the soldiers out because the Kurds will be left there. Left alone.
Right. And then also there was like the whole deal of the oil, you know, like trying to overtake the oil because the Kurds did take over the northeast section of Syria, which is the dominant, you know, producing area for oil and natural gas, if I'm not mistaken. So
it is, but it's not oil or mineral rich up there compared to other parts of the Middle East.
Right, but it is enough. it's got enough for someone to care.
It's enough to power their domestic mm-hmm. Their domestic economy, but their oil imports anyway. They need to import oil from Iran anyway, so it's not like they're even without with the Kurds over that landmass. They're an importer, so it's just not. It's not dumb, and I think you're going to end up eventually. I mean, you could end up eventually with a Chinese India type situation where there's a border brawl, and I mean that's the last thing that you want.
Yeah.
Because that could just potentially cascade into something really scary.
The last thing I'll say on this particular car crash, because that's what this is, it's just literally a car accident, is that I think both parties are responsible for this shit, because if you, I'm watching this video on loop on Twitter, and like the more I look at it, the more clear how stupid this was. There's like miles and miles of open field that these guys are in, and like, yeah, you paint a really good picture about how many different forces are in the same area, and that is true, but like physically speaking, there's miles of open road, miles of open land that these vehicles are driving on, and they just chose to drive this close to each other, you know? So they're both at fault. Fuck them all.
Yes, Cuban B. Yes, Cuban B. All right. So here's kind of the main thing. This is a kind of a segue, or maybe this is not a great segue, but we're doing it anyway. But we're going into more Russia stuff, or at least more
Russia.
More anti-Putin narrative, because Danny and I have pledged our allegiance to Vladimir Putin. At the beginning of the show, check our archives. We've pledged our allegiance to the Kremlin very early on in the show. So I just want you guys to know. So Alexei Navalny, for those of you who don't know who that is, you're probably in the same boat as many Russian people. So Alexei Navalny is a anti-Putin activist, former blogger. He is the leader of the Russia of the Future party, and he was poisoned, allegedly.
He was definitely poisoned. The German medical people say he was definitely poisoned.
Poisoned, allegedly. But it seems like he was actually poisoned. And he was on a flight. The whole story is just kind of murky, though, because he was on a flight from Siberia to Moscow.
From Tomsk to Omsk.
Tomsk to Moscow.
From Tomsk to Omsk.
He felt ill while on this plane. And the plane had to make an emergency landing in Omsk, where he was put on a ventilator.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially he was, you know, put in a coma, or an induced coma.
Yeah.
And the initial tests that the Russians made were, they didn't find any poison. But his family then requested that he be moved to Germany,
mm-hmm.
where he is moved. And the doctors there say there may have been evidence of poison. Now, when I first heard about the story, I thought he was a diabetic. I was like, oh, it sounds like what he's suffering from, like low blood sugar, that he is a diabetic. But what's your take on this? Like, what?
Oh, he was 100% poisoned. Who poisoned him and why is up for debate, but he was definitely poisoned.
Why do you think he was poisoned?
Well, just the symptoms that he showed on the flight, kind of the delay in the onset of the symptoms, and also the Germans said that he was poisoned, so he's definitely poisoned, right? It's just like who poisoned him and how he was poisoned, and more importantly, why he was poisoned is really, like, I think that part is up for debate. And also, just, you know, if we're talking about it, people who are in and around the Russian sphere, you know, if they're not in line, you know, there is a long track record of people being poisoned. And Alexei Navalny happened to be one of the opposition party leaders. So why not?
Well, the thing about opposition party is that I've never really, from everything I've read about him or heard about Alexei Navalny, is that he is a kind of a failed wish list of an anti-Putin opponent. He is anti-Putin, and he has most of the policies that you would want him to have, I guess, as opposition, or the best you can have, besides him being a kind of a lunatic on some things.
He is a lunatic. He totally is.
You could even call him a raging lunatic.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. With some of the things that this guy has said. But As far as like policy wise, you know, he's anti-corruption, wants to break up the power of the central government. He's more favors the foreign policy of NATO and the U.S. So in that regard, he's good. Now, some of the reasons why
he's a lunatic.
I call him a lunatic. Yeah. Just because of the things that come out of his mouth. He's a bona fide racist.
100%.
I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, no. Yeah, he's definitely a racist.
He's a hardcore you know, Russian nationalist. He has been on his YouTube channel calling Muslims cockroaches.
Yep.
He refers to people from the Caucasus as a not really nice word that probably just shouldn't say.
Right.
He's in a kind of a weird guy.
Right.
And he's also a blogger. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not something to shame him for, but he was a blogger turned kind of political activist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the Russia of the Future Party is not even a registered political party. Now, you need to come back and say that, you know, this was
it's like the Tea Party, you know, it's like the, you know, not an official party, but like a party.
Yeah, exactly. It's a more of a movement type thing.
Right.
However, there's two things. First of all, like I haven't really seen that much evidence that he's popular in Russia. Just due to polling, polling his own polls only show about like 2% of people would actually vote for him. This guy hasn't run for president ever. It's not like he's running against Vladimir. Like the way it's being painted, I just hate this. The narrative is that this guy is running against Vladimir Putin in the next election. So we need to back this guy, and he poisons him. Like he's not a. I don't see him as a real political opponent to Putin. He's kind of just an activist, an anti-Putin activist.
Yeah, and I think by definition, any anti-Putin activist is kind of against Putin, right? I'd agree with you in the sense that like he's not like an official opponent, but like a lot of people are pushing him towards this, you know, like putting him in that box. And it's a little weird, you know, given what we've said about why he's a lunatic, that, you know, the mainstream media kind of like naturally puts him as the, you know, anti-Putin, you know.
Do you know why? Because you can't say, because the second most powerful, or the party that always comes in second to all the presidential elections, is the Communist Party in Russia, and you can't back the Communist Party.
No, you can't. Yeah. So if you want to be like anti-Putin, you have to back somebody, and then this guy just happens to be the best option that they have, I guess, you know.
I just like his image is the image I have of him is when he was protesting with that guy from I forget his name, but he it's like the National Russian Party. It was a party, their flag was a combination of the swastika and the hammer and sickle and the one flag.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, who are these people? Like, why are you getting involved with people who are involved in this type of, on these type, with these types of symbols? At some point, some symbols are so poisoned that, you know, you need to stop.
Poison, them. And, get it?
Yeah, poison. No pun intended. Some symbols are so poisoned that you need to stop using them.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, their real implications are is that these guys are fucking fascists. Like they're real fascists.
Yeah.
Just like in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of an odd situation, and it's Russia, you know. So
it's Russia.
There's a long history of very strange assassinations, and there's a long history of businessmen being assassinated, tycoons being assassinated, media personalities
former party
being
members,
assassinated,
things like
party
that,
members
yeah.
being mm-hmm. assassinated. There is a really it's not out of the ordinary for someone to be poisoned or killed. Yeah. It's just kind of strange. I'm trying to put the math together of how, or not the math, but how the logistics and how that would have went down, because they're claiming that they were in an airport and you had a cup of tea. It's always a cup of tea. We'll get to that. Right. And someone poisoned his tea. And then he got sick. Well, I don't want to say this because I know I'm going to come off as a nut, but I'm just going to say there could be a possibility of this. Maybe he did this for – maybe he poisoned himself.
Well, sure.
I don't think it's likely that he did that.
Well, sure. That's always like it's within the realm of possibility. But
one can't come to at least a thought – that this guy, maybe he did it for attention. Because there's an upcoming, his plan is that he's not gonna, the presidential election is in 2024 in Russia. Mm-hmm. So he wants to do the run in, you know, whatever, 2021, like government, right. Whatever the elections are.
I mean, if he did this to himself, he's like fucking long shot, because last I heard he was in a coma, right?
He dosed himself. I don't think he actually did it to himself. I don't know.
I mean, it's within the realm of possibility, but I just think it's so unlikely. I don't even entertain the idea.
Yeah. I agree. I agree with that. It's definitely a very far-reaching thing to conclude. But if it ever comes out that he did, then you can all say, oh, I guess
Henry was right.
But no, I think it is maybe a little bit too soon to start. And there's no evidence to suggest that he did that to himself.
Right.
But I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like, okay, he was definitely poisoned, right? Based on all the, you know, factors. But who poisoned him and why? And then I guess the easy finger to point is that Putin did it, or that Putin's government did it, you know? Some extension of Putin's party did it to Alexei Navalny because he's an opposition leader, heavy, like, you know, finger quotes. You know, he's just like a guy that says shit that they don't like. And he's the guy that the mainstream media in the United States likes to back sometimes, despite the fact that he's a nut job.
They like to give lip service to him because, I mean, you can just easily write a blog about Putin opposition leader, you know, harassed, Putin opposition leader poisoned, Putin opposition leader thrown in jail.
Right, exactly.
But then you can't be like, oh, this guy who is probably the antithesis to a lot of the views that these mainstream outlets claim to
that the readers have, for that matter. Yeah.
Doesn't really represent. But I want to actually, I don't know what happened. Well, I guess we'll maybe find out more information in the future. But I want to just, what made this incident sound at least familiar to me, or what it made me think of, was perhaps the most famous, because there's dozens of these cases.
So many, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think the most famous one was the Alexander Litvinenko one.
Litvinenko, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In 2006. So in 2006, there was a former KGB officer named Alexander Litvinenko was allegedly assassinated on British soil. That's according correct. To the British government, his tea was spiked.
Ooh, his tea.
Again, we're going with the tea, with a massive dose of radioactive polonium.
Polonium-210?
Polonium-210.
Mm-hmm.
And the finger was pointed directly at the FSB,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
is the successor of the KGB.
Right.
Now, do you know anything about polonium?
Yes, I know plenty about polonium.
Can you please explain
what
polonium-210 is?
Sure. So, super nerdy. Polonium-210 is obviously a radioactive isotope. It is an isotope of polonium. And it is a prominent contaminant in the environment. It mostly affects seafood and tobacco. And it's also extremely toxic for people because it's incredibly radioactive. Some fun facts about it. A single gram of polonium-210 generates about 140 watts of power. That's ridiculous. A single gram. Just think about that. You know, one little bag of weed can give you 140 watts. It's nuts. It's really strong power output. But it not to get too much into the weeds, but it emits what's called alpha particles, and they're stopped in a very short distance when it's in a dense media like lead, and then they release the energy. So they actually use it as a lightweight heating source for a lot of different things. Specifically like space stuff, right? Like satellites. But one interesting thing that they also use it in was in Russian Lukoid rovers that were deployed on the surface of the moon. And they did so to kind of keep the internal components warm during the lunar nights, because it can get quite cold on the moon. So that's a Russian rover, by the way. So, you know, heavily underscore the Russian part of it. But, you know, where could you get it from? It's not very easy to get it, actually. It does incur, like, naturally in the environment. However, to get enough of it to kill somebody or, you know, power something, you know, electronic, would require people with a whole lot of expertise and connections. It also would require some pretty sophisticated technology, like lab facilities, access to a nuclear reactor, right? So not a lot of people can get their hands on polonium. Just for some context around like how scarce polonium-210 is, only about 100 grams of polonium-210 is made in nuclear reactors every year around the world combined. So 100 grams, that's nothing. You know, that's not even a kilo, you know? You know, alternatively, you could get it from like a commercial supplier, but again, you know, getting it from a commercial supplier would probably raise some suspicions, because this stuff is highly radioactive, and pretty much every radioactive element that is bought or sold anywhere is pretty well regulated and monitored. But yeah, that's what I know about polonium. But I do also know that it's known as the perfect poison. And that's because, you know, these alpha particles that I was talking about, they can't travel through skin or paper. So they're actually pretty easy to transport. So you can actually smuggle a very small amount into any country in like a glass vial. It's also super hard to detect with, you know, traditional, you know, security measures, like, you know, in hospital tests and airport scanners, because it doesn't emit any gamma radiation, or very, very little gamma radiation, which is what those scanners are actually looking for. So, you know, like a Geiger counter, as an example, is looking for gamma rays, and polonium barely gives off any gamma rays. It is very radioactive, but it just doesn't give off gamma rays. And so polonium has no color, it has no taste, so you can easily add it to any food or drink. It can't be easily detected, and, you know, it basically decays inside of a human body, and it can continue to do so over several weeks or longer. So, like, in some cases of the poisoning, you don't, like, immediately start showing symptoms, right? So you can poison somebody, and then, like, a couple days later, that's when they start feeling, like, extremely sick, right? Which gives you a lot of distance. Like, the more time that you have between, you know, now and the poisoning, the more likely it is that you're not going to get caught. So that's what I know about polonium.
Well, the thing about polonium is, aren't you going to be leaving a radioactive trail?
Yes,
that's the issue. So,
you can leave a radioactive trail
where you were, and that's essentially what happened. They were able to trace back
to that bench, right? No, the in the park, in the middle of the park.
Yeah, and also across Europe.
Right. So, like, it does leave a trail, but you have to know to look for it. You know what I mean? So, like, because it's hard to test in hospitals, right? Like, because it doesn't give off gamma radiation, it's hard to pinpoint that, in fact, this was polonium-210. And unless you know to look for traces of polonium-210, to look for this, like, radiation trail, you're not going to look for that. You know what I mean? It just so happens that, you know, in the case of Litvinenko, they happened to find that radioactive trail, which is where, you know, which is what we were talking about. But, you know, this is like, was like a super high profile murder. I suppose you can say that any of them would be super high profile murders or attempted murders, right? So it does raise some questions about why the fuck you would use something like that when you could just like shoot somebody, you know?
Why would you use a? Because I'm imagining it would cost millions of dollars for that dose.
You know, I don't know how much it would cost, but given how much of it is produced every year, yeah, it's probably very expensive.
It's probably incredibly expensive. It has to be potentially. It has to be smuggled out of the state facility. Like someone needs to smuggle it out.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you're not gonna just like waltz out of a nuclear laboratory and just be like, hey, I'm taking this. No big deal.
I kind of feel that the idea that the Russians would poison Litvinenko with a rare radioactive isotope is ludicrous, and it doesn't even bear real consideration when they could easily just shoot them in the face, like you just said. Why would they? They have to be the worst damn assassins of all time. Like, they have to be that bad of.
Well, I wouldn't call them bad. I wouldn't call them bad.
They're going to leave a trail like that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call them bad assassins. I would call them poorly. It's like wasting. It's like overkill. You know what I mean? Like, it's way too expensive. Too much logistical nightmare. But they did their job, right? They killed him. And to date, even still till today, no one can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Russia killed them, right? So I mean, they did what they needed to do. They got away with it. So, you know,
they didn't really get blamed. They didn't really get away with it. It's like the consensus across the world that they did it.
But they can't prove it without a shadow of a doubt. That's what I'm saying.
The British report that came out has highly suggested that they did do it.
Right.
And it's
here's the thing about that, though. So I know that you sent me that article by Justin Raimondo, and I thought it was very good, right? And I thought that, you know, he brings up a lot of really great points that bring up the kind of plausible deniability about whether or not Russia did it. And, you know, he brings up a number of other entities or people that are more likely to have done it because of. He really goes in depth about Litvinenko's dealings leading up to his murder. However, the thing that I keep coming back to is the fact that he was in fact killed with polonium-210, right? And there's only like so many people in the world who can access this realistically and then weaponize it. There's only so many like actors that can do that. And like the fact does remain that he was killed by polonium poisoning.
Well, isn't there a possibility that it could be due to a smuggling operation gone bad?
If he was the one smuggling polonium-210, sure.
And if it is the case that it was a... Because I don't think it was like the Russian mob who did it. Like I think it would either be state,
the FSB, or the CIA. Or it would be, like, or those would be the two actors. You know,
it would be an intelligence agency, right? Or it would be an accidental spill. Because there were suggestions that he was involved in smuggling operations, and if it went wrong, I mean, he would have the accidental spill would have killed him.
So you're talking about the what was that guy? The SISMI link, this the link to the SISMI agent, Marco Mancini. So like they were involved in that what was it, Nigeria, or what country were they doing like fake uranium?
Nigerian forgeries. You're talking about that.
Yep.
The yellow cake uranium.
Yeah. Exactly. The Niger uranium forgeries. Sorry, not Nigeria.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So he was probably associated with that. But the thing is that those were uranium forgeries, not polonium, you know? So it is a different isotope. It's like different chemical, different set of like tools, and also a different set of sources that you would need to create those things.
Well, I don't think those events are related with each other. I'm just saying that I think it's possible that there could have been a smuggling operation gone wrong. And if it was a smuggling operation gone wrong, the real story is like, what were they planning on doing with it?
I mean, maybe. The thing is, like, he wasn't, as far as I understand, he wasn't going anywhere, right? Like, there wasn't any planned trips for him to have left. So if it was a smuggling operation, he was just, what, smuggling it to keep it himself, you know? Like, that's weird. Because he wasn't going anywhere, you know? But he wasn't going anywhere. You know what I mean? So, I mean, unless he was selling it in Britain, which I guess could be a possibility. I don't know. It's just such a fucking stretch, especially when we think about how many people have been poisoned or attempted murdered in connection to Russia and the FSB. You know, like it just doesn't. Occam's razor, like easiest answer being, you know, the truest answer. It's not easiest to say that he was involved in a smuggling ring of polonium. It's more easy to say that Russia offed him because he's opposition.
Well, if it was a smuggling operation gone wrong, you can imagine it would be the most dangerous story to cover. Where
for sure
you would probably die if you were a journalist even covering it.
Probably because like you don't.
Because like it would implicate other foreign governments.
Hell yeah, and like I said, all of this radioactive material, like when it moves, even commercially, it is heavily monitored, heavily watched by, you know, international, you know, consortium. So, you know, that to pull it off, you'd have to fucking avoid the watchful eye of many developed nations.
Well, let's talk about who this guy was. So he was a former former KGB.
Right.
He was FSB as well.
Yeah, I guess he did both. He was there for the transition.
He was a... So do you remember the Russian apartment bombings?
Yep. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about that on the show, actually.
Yeah. So there was a series of terrorist attacks in Russia that happened in 1999, and they were all across different Russian cities, and they killed more than 300 people. So he wrote a book called Blowing Up Russia that blamed the apartment bombings on the FSB and Putin. His main thesis was that the FSB was, you know, pulled this off to empower Putin's election.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that was
like a 9/11 kind of thing.
Exactly. Right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a 9/11 type conspiracy theory.
Like a false flag idea.
A false flag idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that whole story, we're going into a pretty
some
big
crazy
conspiracy
areas, yeah.
The conspiracy lands on this episode, but it's fun to think about it. The Yeltsin government was notoriously corrupt. Like the Yeltsin government in Russia was maybe the most corrupt government in at least modern history that we know of. And these guys, this is where the story comes from. So there was a good chance that Yeltsin and a lot of the guys around him were going to be put in prison after his second term as president. He had charges on him. The Duma, they collected charges. They impeached him, and they were charging him with unconstitutionally breaking up the Soviet Union. They were charging him for what he did in 1993 in the constitutional crisis. Because in 1993, Yeltsin, he literally shelled parliament. The reason why there's no Russian parliament and there's a Duma. A Duma is something that from like the 18, you know, way back from whenever. It's like an ancient, not an ancient thing, but it's a older tradition before the Soviet Union. The parliament was dissolved by Yeltsin, and there was almost a full-scale civil war, and he ends up shelling the parliament building back in 1993. He was also charged with genocide because of the Russian mortality rate dropped significantly in the 90s after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And then he was, they were also blaming him on the start of the first Chechen War in 94, because that war was basically like almost another Vietnam type war. It was a really terrible bogging down war. There was no wins. It was just a complete unmitigated disaster for Russia. And Yeltsin was also he wasn't really the person in charge. He was a drunk. You know, he was once found wandering on the streets of D.C. with no clothes on.
It's a funny story.
Looking for a pizza. There's stories from Clinton when they've met where he was just piss wasted. And in addition to being a drunk, he also had health issues,
mm-hmm.
as many drunks do have when they're older. He was in and out of the hospital the entire time in his presidency. That the later half in like 96, he was in the hospital. He was in and out of the hospital all the time. The people who actually controlled the government were Jaegergeider and Chubais, who were the two architects of the shock therapy plan. And that was the plan to transition the former Soviet Union from a state-run communist economy to a private capitalist economy. And we talked about this on our last episode and in some previous episodes.
Excuse me.
The transition from Russia's Soviet experience to a capitalist experience was really rough.
Yeah.
It was not. It was really bad. It couldn't have gone any worse from transitioning from a state-run economy to a centralized economy to a private economy. Basically, all the fears that a communist would bring up from doing that actually happened in Russia. There were a branch of businessmen who became oligarchs, and they did it by hijacking the state for private interest. And there are a lot of them, but the ones that most people will know and the ones that we've talked about are Boris Berezovsky and Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Who Mikhail Khodorkovsky is in jail. Putin mm-hmm. put him in jail.
Right.
In the 90s, it was basically impossible to tell the difference between Russian organized crime and the Russian state. Like there was really no line between that. And I guess a good way to describe what it was like there was you know how communist propaganda, it preached that making money in a free market was purely predatory.
Mm-hmm.
Behind every fortune was like a legacy of theft and lies and murder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the American industrialists, like they would always bring up the robber barons and how they were nothing but criminals.
Right.
That was you know, the left. That was the propaganda that was taught to kids in school.
Sounds pretty familiar to me. sounds like we're talking about it still.
Well, the Russian business magnates, they absorbed that image of Western capitalism.
Right.
Like they came like they
took it as like a cue. Like, oh, yeah, this is what we got to do.
Okay. But it wasn't real capitalism. Like no. it was crony capitalism.
Right. And that's putting it lightly. I think there's a better word for it.
What?
I don't know what the word is, but I feel like crony capitalism seems like it's accurate, but it's also like not even, it's not as impactful, like because of how crazy it was.
Well, it just should be a completely different type of it should just have a completely different definition to what it is. But essentially, crony capitalism is when the government dishes out favors to their friends mm-hmm. or to a selective group of businessmen at the expense of other businessmen.
Right.
And they're essentially giving them welfare. But they're doing it not through, like, these other companies aren't getting favoritism from their actual products that they're producing. Their favoritism just comes directly from the state due to either their lobbying or their personal connections with people in the government. It has nothing to do with what they provide to the consumer.
Right.
So that just, that,
in fact, it's like in spite defeats, of what they give, what they offer
it,
the consumer.
It kind of defeats the purpose of, the whole purpose of, I mean, I don't like saying the purpose of capitalism, because I don't think capitalism is a, is like a philosophy. I think of it as more of like a law. Like, it kind of just damage it. It completely prevents the impact of a free market economy, because you can be a loser essentially and still win in the marketplace and not have the consumer choose if you're a winner or a loser.
Right. So it's no longer capitalism anymore, is what was happening during the transition.
It never was capitalism. And it's hard. It's hard to transform a state-run economy mm-hmm. into a capitalist economy. Like, it's very difficult to make that transition.
It's also kind of funny, because like proponents, like people who are still into communism today, always say that, oh, you know, there's never been true communism out there. It's always been like corrupted in one way or another. So like the corrupted communism, like the pinnacle of communism, you know, in Soviet Russia that collapsed and fell, was then replaced by, you know, fake capitalism. So fake communism was replaced by fake capitalism. Russia never gets any wins here. At least it sounds that way.
They really don't. And just like, it's so much to get into about some of the financial crimes that were going on there. Mm-hmm. And we talked about this on last episode as well. I don't know if we're beating a dead horse or not, but essentially they were running like this really awful voucher scheme. And then they had these kangaroo auctions where one guy would auction only $1,000 more than the other one. They were buying up entire industries. They were buying up, for example, I think it was Gazprom. They purchased it for, it was Yukos, one of the state oil companies. They purchased for $250 million when the actual valuation of the company was around $4 billion. Mm-hmm. So they're buying up these industries that Russia has a lot of mineral resources. It has a lot of forest. It has a lot of oil. It has a lot of natural resources. Mm-hmm. So the value of those companies that are producing those resources are really high. And there was a real just awful central banking scam that was going on frequently, where banks were just requesting, they were giving out loans and getting money from central banks, and they were just, it was just unchecked theft in the highest order. And there was so much organized crime that there was just no separation between the people in the government and the actual mafia figures on the street. So
it was like New York in the 70s.
Yeah, it was like New York in the 70s times 10. So all these guys, a lot of these oligarchs were getting really unpopular by the end of the Yeltsin regime. Yeltsin himself was impeached. He was incredibly unpopular. He wasn't even popular when he won his election a second time in the 96 election, but there was just so much money put behind his presidency that he was able to squeak it out. But there was a good chance they were going to go to jail. So they actually put Putin in charge of the FSB to prevent the criminal investigations that were going on. Specifically, a lot of them were linked to Boris Berezovsky. Like, mm-hmm. like they were, it was like a direct cause where they put him in charge because they thought that he was a loyalist. What's interesting about Putin is that he later turns on the oligarchs, but at the beginning of his career, I guess as a politician, you know, he was subsidized by them. And before Putin was actually appointed head of the FSB, because that's what he was, the head of the FSB in the Yeltsin government, or at least at the end of the Yeltsin government, I think he was appointed in 1998. But before he was a KGB guy, and he kind of had an unremarkable career. He had been stationed in Dresden, in East Germany. Dresden.
He was a Stasi.
And he was a Stasi. He worked with the Stasi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when he retired, as a colonel. I think his first political position was he was the first deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. But he was eventually he cozied up with.
He worked his way up the ladder real quick by kissing ass.
Yeah, he definitely kissed ass and found his patrons and the Yeltsin government. The big one was Chubais, who was the original prime minister for Yeltsin,
mm-hmm.
who was the guy, one of the key guys, the kind of a technocrat type guy who where shock therapy came from. He worked himself up the ladder. He became the deputy chief of staff. And I guess what he was doing is that he was kind of serving as a presidential auditor on like provincial governments. So he would come in and he would audit like governors, like, you know, how we have states, if the federal government was going state to state and auditing them by some guidelines and
which would give him an incredible amount of dirt on pretty much all the governors by doing that.
Yeah, it would make him quite powerful, mm-hmm. to do that.
Right.
And he was put in charge of the FSB because I guess the powers that be, they stopped trusting the guy that they had, who was head of the FSB, and they canned him and put Putin in charge. And the first thing that Putin did when he was FSB was that he fired all the untrustworthy division heads, and he even, you know, ruined the lives of anti-corruption investigators. There was like a case of a prosecutor that was going after the Yeltsin government, and there was a on the basically the state-owned TV, there was like a broadcast of him sleeping with hookers, like in real time.
Yep.
Like, imagine if that happened too.
It's like the real life pee-pee tapes, you know.
the real life pee-pee tapes happened.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
The real life piss tapes.
Mm-hmm.
That would sure be
effective.
Still
want to see that video.
You want to see that video?
Allegedly.
Hey, I would love to see it too.
Number one trending on Pornhub.
It would be the most watched film video of all time.
Like pornographic video? Yeah, probably.
Just video ever.
You think so?
It would beat Charlie Bit My Finger.
Charlie
Bit My Finger.
It really hurts. Ouch, Charlie.
Ouch, that hurt.
I wonder how old those kids are now. They're like 37, you know?
I was the prime of my life when I was... I was a prime.
Charlie's in jail
when
now.
When I was a little lad, when I was Charlie.
Charlie's in jail now. The little wanker. Bit one too many people.
That wanker.
I'm gonna have to Google what's up with Charlie.
Charlie is a fucking tosser.
Fucking twat.
He's a fucking coot. All right. So where were we? So yeah. So he, I mean, he was a loyal guy to Yeltsin when he was
when he was working for him, right?
For him, and he was eventually promoted to prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why he was picked is because they thought he was a loyalist. The opposition was in threat of going to jail, and meaning Yeltsin and everyone around him. So all these rich, powerful oligarchs, people in his cabinet, there was a good chance that they were going to get in serious trouble. But the big problem is that they were trying to groom him to be president, but he was a bureaucrat that no one really knew who he was.
Right.
So
he was relative nobody.
There's a reason why just random bureaucrats don't really run for president, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we decided to just
we want to rein you in, we need to know something about you.
Well, usually you have some political experience running or being elected to something, and then, mm-hmm. then you run. It's kind of rare to pull what a George H.W. Bush did and you know, come as CIA director to president of the United States.
Right.
But essentially, that's kind of what
Putin did. Kind of what he did, right, yeah, totally.
It's kind of a benchmark. I think they're pretty similar people, or at least their career trajectories, because they both were intelligence or directed the head of intelligence. You know, they both did kind of crazy stuff.
Primary difference was that Putin keeps getting elected and only got one term.
that is a primary difference. But they're both better than, you know, other options. Like George H.W. Bush is better than his son George W. Bush.
Yeah.
And Putin is better than Yeltsin. So this is where the conspiracy comes from, that we get with Litvinenko and the Russian apartment bombings. So in March 1999, the personal envoy to Yeltsin was kidnapped, and he was – they wanted to go to war with the Chechens. And the first war was an unmitigated disaster. So they were having a hard time convincing the public to, you know, get behind that. However, the Chechens ended up doing them a big favor because they ended up crossing the border to Dagestan, and they created a Islamic State. Because a lot of these guys were Wahhabi fanatic types. Like these were guys that were fighting in the Soviet Union in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, some of them were linked to Osama bin Laden, who at the time, I guess, wasn't a household name yet, but he was still the prime suspect of the 1998 embassy bombing in Africa. And these guys were, to go back like deeper into like to Boris Berezovsky specifically, he was heavily involved in organized crime through his car dealership when he first started making his money.
Mm-hmm.
The way that he first funded his enterprises was through a very corrupt car dealership, where they would bribe the manufacturer to get a lower rate on the cost of the cars that they would get from the assembly line, and their markup price, they'd be making about a 200% profit. It's real crazy. They did it just through bribery.
And they did it all without a wacky, waving, inflatable arm tube man.
It had to be bribery if you didn't have one of those.
How else are they supposed to advertise it, Doc?
But in that market at the time, like the car dealership was like the kind of mafia haven, because it was a cash business.
Mm-hmm.
And you, in order to operate in that industry at that time, you had to have a roof. A roof is basically like a protectorate.
Right.
His protectorate was the Chechens, like the Chechen mafia. The Chechen mafia came up after the fall of the Soviet Union. They came into, you know, these cities like Moscow, and they ran organized crime in a lot of areas. Like, they were ruthless. So his foot soldiers were the Chechen mafia. And he had donated to at least some of them. He donated a lot of money to a lot of the guys who were part of the rebellion. So it started
part of the quasi-Islamic state when they crossed into Dagestan.
It's starting to sound a little bit familiar mm-hmm. into things that are going on in the Middle East, and mm-hmm. You can draw the connection that, you know, there was a former one of the ISIS commanders is from Chechnya, who fought in the Second Chechen War, like, because a lot of them had military experience, so they were able to become leaders within the Islamic State,
right?
Because there was a lot of linkage between the Saudi Wahhabis in Afghanistan and people who fought against the Soviet Union in southern Russia. Mm-hmm. So these apartment bombings in September of 1999, the first one killed about 100 people. The second one killed about 118 people. There was about 5 blasts in a 3-week period, and over 300 people died. And it was essentially, again, like, a good comparison is like 9/11.
Right. It's like potentially a false flag operation to try and drum up, you know, nationalism and internal support.
And there was, after that, there mm-hmm. was
a massive, lot of it.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of support for that. And Putin was type of the guy who was kind of leading the propaganda on that, of being the tough guy in charge. He would, like, carry around a machete, and, you know, he was kind of drumming up the support. All the news coverage was really favorable, just like how George Bush, the media coverage was pretty favorable to him after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the 9/11 truthers would eat up, you know, this Russian apartment bombing, you know, story, because, you know, it's got a lot of the same trappings, you know.
So I guess that's where that conspiracy comes from, that the FSB did the apartment bombings in Russia. Mm-hmm. They were doing it to facilitate the election of Vladimir Putin, who right. also at the time he became president before he was actually elected, because Yeltsin stepped down mm-hmm. and he was his successor when he was the prime minister. So he also had the advantage of being the incumbent. But through the first election that he ever ran as president, which is a pretty good advantage, is definitely, especially in a crisis mode. So he was definitely a patron of that system. But the funny thing, and this is something that I myself am trying to figure out what happened, is that what was the actual how did that relationship between Putin and the Russian oligarchs go wrong? Like what happened? Like, what were the reasons that he turned on them? Like, was he planning on turning on them all along?
It sounded like a red wedding to me.
It's what do you think that he was planning on turning on them all along?
I mean, I think that's the most romantic way to think about it, that he was just plotting this whole, like, government takeover and just kissing ass in the right ways and cozying up to the right people. And then when the time was right, he was just like, all right, fuck you guys.
Yeah, and I think that definitely could be the case. I think it could have been just like the populace demanded.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been political pressure for sure. It just
could have been political pressure.
100% could have been.
But I'm sure there was something internal or just kind of nasty involved in it, right, where he did turn on
seem organic, right? It doesn't seem like something that would just happen. It seems like it was there's a good reason why it happened. Like, it was engineered, it was manufactured that way. But I guess the reason why we're talking about all of this is, you know, to kind of draw this line back to, you know, all of the poisonings and all the deaths, is because Alexander Litvinenko wrote the book about Russian apartment bombings, right? And about this, like, Russian, you know, 9/11, basically, right? And, you know, kind of like sounding the alarm about how Putin bad, right? And he was killed.
I think the most logical explanation, though, for the Russian apartment bombings is that they were Russian, they were Chechen terrorists. You know,
yeah, that's the most likely story.
I just
want
to just just say that
100%.
It's kind of an Occam's razor type thing to say, well, you know, they had a history of doing suicide bombing and bombing things and killing people and assassinating people, that it was entirely possible that they committed this themselves.
Mm-hmm.
However, they didn't take responsibility for it.
Right.
Exactly when it happens. Usually groups like ISIS now, in the modern sense, they take responsibility for things they didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be like they took responsibility for the Las Vegas shooting, if we remember.
Yeah, for like a minute. And then it was like, no, that was some American dude. Yeah, dude, but like, you know, kind of bringing this back to what we're talking about, you know, like this guy, Litvinenko, was trying to red pill everybody, you know, or at least in his time, he was trying to red pill everybody on this Russian apartment bombing situation, making them look bad, you know.
Or he was just a raging lunatic. Like, it's
either way, it looked bad for Putin.
I am not 100% convinced of the narrative that that could have happened. I think it's a possibility, though. I think it's a possibility that there could have been some dealings within someone in the Russian state who did do that, who did facilitate that with Chechen terrorists, especially because there were known patrons within the Russian government who were working with Chechens. So it wouldn't surprise me, but I think that it could also just be a clear case of, hey, this was a Chechen terrorist attack in Russia, which happens.
Right, you know, but like kind of independent of that, right? Like who did the Russian apartment bombing is almost irrelevant, because, you know, it's more about who is trying to make Putin look bad, right? And that was Litvinenko. Like whether he was doing it because he's a fucking lunatic and like a weird truther, you know, like apartment bomber truther, or because he legitimately wanted to try and take Putin down, that's irrelevant. What is relevant is that it doesn't make Putin look good, doesn't make Russia look good, and then he was offed. He was poisoned. He died. And there's like a long list of fucking people who have either died or have been attempted murder, right? There was this op-ed that you actually sent to me from the Post, the writer Vladimir Karamurza, right? This dude actually survived a poisoning. I think he's actually survived two poisonings now that I'm remembering it correctly. And he kind of goes into real detail about like how, you know, horrific and painful and like how much all the residual like health issues happen because of the poisoning. And he's basically saying that, you know, we should pay attention to this plot on Alexei Navalny because, you know, he went through it twice. And then he goes on to list a bunch of, you know, different people that have suffered this fate. So example, Ukrainian presidential candidate Viktor Yushchenko. He lived, but his face was disfigured because of the poison. The Russian investigative journalist and opposition lawmaker Yuri Shchekochkin, whatever. That was in 2003. He died a terribly horrible death, organ failure. His fucking skin peeled off. Like, nuts. But evidently the medical records for his death were sealed off and nobody knows how he died or something like that. Journalist Anna Politkovskaya, opposition activist and performance artist Pyotr Verzolov.
Well, she was killed on Putin's birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. And then former Canadian Justice Minister Erwin Coulter. That's, I guess, not a Russian, but, you know, kind of in the sphere of this all. And it was blamed on Russia or on Putin largely. Foreign Security Service operative Alexander Litvinenko, like we've been talking about for a while. And also Sergei Skripal. They were both attacked in the UK, in Britain, right? So Skripal, he survived, but Litvinenko did not. I guess the crazy part about it, and this kind of goes back to that Justin Raimondo article that you sent for me to read, you know, while he goes through kind of a long, you know, list of potential alternatives, and some of the ones that he makes a pretty good case for, I think what's crazy to like not consider is that Russia did it, just because of the length of like the lengthy list of people that have, you know, been killed. And this is not, by far not a exhaustive list either. There have been plenty more that have been shot and killed and so on and so forth, and probably even more that we'll never find out about it because they just did such a good job at covering it up. I guess my point is, you know, where Justin Romano and I disagree is, you know, like, he seems to believe that Litvinenko, he couldn't have been killed by the Russians, because why the fuck would they do that? That essentially is like a small-scale nuclear attack on a British citizen, which, by the way, Litvinenko at the time was he was like given British citizenship, on a British citizen on British soil. It's like a nuclear, tiny little nuclear strike on one British citizen, and that would be nuts, right? Like, if that came out that was the case, that was true, it would be nuts. That's cause for war, you know? Why would he do that? And like, the way that I look at it, it's just like, polonium is a pretty effective like tool to kill people, you know, and they just happen to use that, and it's quiet. And you know, even though everyone in the world seems to believe that the Russians did it, you know, they can't bring them to court about it. And if everybody agrees that the Russians did it, you know, then Britain should have gone to war about it, but they didn't. Why? Because they couldn't, beyond a shadow of a doubt, prove it. And so just think for a moment, like, hypothesize that in fact Russia did do the Litvinenko killing, and they used polonium, and they murdered him, and he's dead, and they did that on British soil to a British citizen, and nothing happened. Nothing happened to them. Like, they weren't hit by British sanctions because of it, you know? Like, nobody declared war. I don't even think they sent them a strongly worded letter, you know?
The press completely condemned Russia.
Yeah, the press condemned it, and the press also, you know, promoted a lot of Russophobia about it, and they definitely jumped on that bandwagon. So that's one negative outcome for it. But like, real negative outcome, I mean, like recompense, like,
well, what are they supposed to do, go to war for a former fucking like thug mafia who is,
but that's what I'm, that's what I'm saying, like dude, no,
this guy,
they're not gonna,
this
go
guy
to
was
war
involved
about
in a blackmailing scheme too.
Yeah.
Like, so
yeah, of course they're not gonna go to war about it. So like, what behavior does that reaffirm in a Russian or in Putin, who says, all right, there's this fucking thug, he lives in Britain, and I want to get rid of him because he's talking too much shit, right? And I'm gonna go ahead and kill him. And then I go ahead and kill him, and I know that by killing him, doesn't matter how I kill him, I don't fucking kill him, polonium, gun, other poison, doesn't matter, I kill him, and literally no one's gonna do shit, Britain's not gonna go to war with me. Yeah, I'm gonna catch some flack in the news, and everyone's gonna say, you know, Russia, 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 but I'm just gonna, you know, skirt it away and be like, you have no proof, where's the proof? And at the end of the day, there is no concrete proof that I did it, and so therefore I can with impunity just murder people just anywhere in the world for political reasons, because that's how I see it right now, you know? Like, that's the area that I'm leaning in, that it in fact was Russia, and that they don't see any real consequences. Like, the media doesn't mean shit. Like, they're just gonna sweep it under the rug and say, like, you can't prove it, so there.
It was just the overall, Putin's overall mentality is that, well, you know, it's just status quo to get rid of opposition.
Right, and what are you gonna do about it when I do? Nothing.
What are the serious considerations that you're gonna do if I just take out one itty bitty journal, well, one itty bitty former
FSB guy.
Former FSB / KGB, right, dude who wrote a, you know, a conspiracy book about me.
Right, because I don't like him. Now, coming back to Alexei Navalny, this is where it gets weird, right? Because it's not like right now it's an election for Putin, you know? It's like, why now? Why did he have to go and kill him now?
Well, let me just pull this back real quick before you make a point, Alexei Navalny.
Yeah.
So it should be brought up that Litvinenko was we're talking about a state that there's not a really large separate, there's not a line between organized crime along with the actual
government
state in itself,
right,
and the government.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess you could say that about all governments, right? Because if the state is organized, because the state is organized crime.
Taxation is theft, Henry.
But I mean, we're talking about like just unprecedented amounts of corruption.
Right.
Apparently, he was involved in blackmailing schemes where he had made a lot of enemies, and it could have been, if it was plutonium, it could have been through one of the enemies he'd made in a Russian crime syndicate.
100%.
Could now, I think that I think that's a possibility. I think it's more likely that it came from an intelligence agency, because you think that would be
it would be easier for them to get the substance. Yeah, exactly.
But we're talking about such high corruption, it probably be it would be easy to transfer it would to make an exchange Maybe. Between the organized crime and the FSB, or the organized crime
right.
And
the government, whatever right. and whoever can actually
whatever who, whatever whoever was in charge of the polonium. Here, you know who was killed from polonium, apparently?
Who?
Arafat.
Yasser Arafat, really?
Yeah.
Well, that raises a bunch of eyebrows.
He was killed from polonium. So yeah, it's been used as a poison before. But yeah, go. I didn't mean to derail you.
No, I mean, like, what I'm trying to point out is that, you know, there's for every potential, like, alleged Russian poisoning, there's always something weird about it that makes you feel like, was it Russia or was it something else? There's always some, like, doubt, right? And the doubt that I'm seeing with this Alexei Navalny is like, why? Why now? Like, why was he killed today, and why not, you know, months ago when it was more relevant, you know?
The thing about these stories is that it's like there's serious consequences for investigating them.
Right.
So it's – so the author of The Godfather of the Kremlin is a book about a lot of these Russian oligarchs in the Yeltsin era. Mm-hmm. He was assassinated right after he wrote the book.
Right.
So it's not something that is that it's not an easy story to cover
from within. Right.
From within. Right. Like, you're gonna make some serious enemies when you do this type of investigative journalist. You know, in the United States, the same thing happens to you if you're an investigative journalist, but you're not usually murdered. If anything, if you go into the conspiracy world, you just won't get hired
right.
by a
You'll
mainstream
just get canceled
public.
Or like, you know,
you won't work for the New York Times, or you won't work for the Washington Post or Wall Street Journal. You won't work at, you know, maybe any, you know, one of those mainstream publications or any internet publication that serves ads. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you're not going to work for the Daily Beast. You'll end up, you know, writing for
some. You're
not
going to work at dailymail.co.uk. Fucking hate them. They have so many ads.
Oh, yeah, they're kind of like a tabloid, you know?
Yeah, I know, but it's just absolute worst website. Like, ugh.
But yeah, Paul Klebnikov was murdered, who was the writer of that book. And he was he was an American. He was the American editor for Forbes Russia. And he covered a lot of the corruption that was going on in the 90s in the Yeltsin regime. And he was killed in 2004. The book was released in 2000. You know, it's obvious that it was probably Boris Berezovsky who killed him, because that was the main subject. That was the guy who he was mainly writing about and uncovering. It's very obvious. He's dead now, Berezovsky.
Right.
I mean, he committed suicide in 2012.
Committed suicide.
I know, committed suicide.
That's the he Jeffrey Epstein'd himself.
I mean, that even that when that happened, they kind of shared that story in the light of that it was a mysterious circumstance that he was murdered. But he had lost his fortune before he died. So I don't know.
I mean, again,
we'll never know.
Nobody's ever gonna know, right? And so that's why, like, I find it so interesting. And in this case, in particular, for Alexei Navalny to just kind of wrap up on this and come full circle, I think it's just it seems clear to me that it was a Russian element or Russia or Putin, you know, mostly because of the long history, the long track record, because of the way that he exhibited symptoms, because of the fact that Germans allowed, you know, had said that he might have been poisoned. It's weird that he was killed now of all times. It's also super weird that if he was poisoned, that they allowed him to go to Germany to be tested and to, you know, to be rehabilitated. Why would they do that? They'd just be like, no, and then you'd die, right? And then the news wouldn't come out that he was apparently poisoned, right? So there's like a ton of doubt from every angle that you look at, whether he was poisoned, whether he did it to himself, whether someone, not the Russian government, like maybe some random, you know, oligarch did it. It's so murky. Like, it's so murky. There's no, like, strong, like, bulletproof theory for any of it.
We can't even grasp American politics. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, we fully don't know what's going on. I mean, we don't really know at all what exactly is going on behind the scenes in a lot of our administrations.
Right.
What the fuck makes you think that we're going to know what's going on
in Russia?
In Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you...
But that's what makes it so interesting, though.
I know, that's what makes it. That's what makes the mythology around it so interesting. And
right.
You know, obviously, there's the chance for exaggerations to be made.
100%,
you know, when
yeah.
comparing Vladimir Putin to Joseph Stalin or Hitler.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's a bit much.
I mean, not at all. I don't think I think we speak. I'll say I speak for both of us right now that we like Putin or anything like that. Like,
no.
I wouldn't say I'm pro Putin, but there are exaggerations about him. But it's just the mystique of all these people dropping dead.
It sounds like a Netflix show. Honestly, like it plays out like a Netflix show, like a crime Netflix show, like Russian House of Cards or some crazy shit.
I think a really good book to read. If anyone's interested in this subject, is I would read The Godfather of the Kremlin. It is a mind-blowing book, and it goes over a lot of these politics in the 90s. Anyone who's interested in the subject more should read that book. But yeah, it would make a crazy TV show. I agree. A Russian House of Cards, it would probably beat out the U.S. House of Cards. But you know what? U.S. politics is pretty fucked up and ruthless and evil too.
Yep.
So it's not like
yeah,
it's much better. It's just not as much like open assassinations of political opponents. You know,
right.
Nancy Pelosi doesn't really need to look both ways before she crosses the street, type of thing.
Yeah, no.
Or it's
Mitch McConnell isn't like, yeah, you know, McConnell's, he doesn't have like a food taster. You know, like, yeah, everybody.
Mitch McConnell doesn't have a food taster.
Oh, I'll tell you what, you know, you should try the sandwich for me and make sure that it's not polonium 210 in there. I'm Mitch McConnell. I'm not a turtle, but I look like a turtle.
Looks like the voice puts some polonium in my salami sandwich.
Oh, man.
We're going to have to truck back the trails and see where it goes. And it goes back all the way to San Francisco.
Oh, man.
That Pelosi.
It has roots in Chad. In Chaz.
It goes all the way to Chaz, so those radical leftists are coming again. They're now poisoning Republican patriots.
Speaking of, have you been watching any of the RNC?
Yeah, actually. Surprisingly, I didn't watch any of the DNC, but then I later caught the the YouTube videos. But I actually watched Eric Trump, Tiffany Trump, and Melania Trump all in one night. And I got to say, I liked Melania's speech the best, but she talked pretty much only about herself and her time as first lady. Eric Trump was a idiot, as usual, just like talking point after talking point. And I was extremely surprised at Tiffany Trump. I don't think I've ever heard her speak that much ever. She's the Trump that everyone loves to forget about. And she was very well spoken, but I hated her message. And that's what I have to say about that.
What was there? I didn't even hear a message. Well, I didn't watch any of it. I haven't watched any conventions except some highlights, memes and stuff.
Just nonsense about how her father is the best saint in the world or something like that, and that he cares deeply about her country. And I'm like, go fuck yourself. No, he doesn't. None of these people do. You think Joe Biden cares? Joe Biden doesn't give a shit either, you know? It's just bullshit, like fancy, fluffy nonsense bullshit.
It's just empty platitudes.
Yeah, it's just that's stupid, why it's not bullshit. Fun to watch.
Yeah. It's just empty, calculated platitudes that 100%. Are delivered to deliver the best message that will make the most turnout. And I think that both parties are running on just
thin ice, honestly.
These really, really kind of they're not, their messages aren't really based in reality. Mm-hmm. The RNC message right now is that
do they have a message? I'm not even sure.
Here's what the RNC is, and this has been the strategy for a long time, since 2000, at least 2017. They are planning on fighting the radical left. That's always been their agenda, to associate whatever Democratic politician who's running against them. I guess maybe at one point they were anticipating Bernie Sanders could be it.
Right.
And their fight is against the radical leftist socialist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did hear that word a lot during a lot of the speeches.
Radical leftist socialist. Yeah. And it's when Sean Hannity gets in, starts talking about the radical left, and then starts saying Nancy Pelosi, it's very mainstream, milquetoast kind of establishment Democrats.
Yeah.
You're just wait, I don't think these guys are socialists. I don't think
you're stretching a little bit.
I don't buy that Nancy Pelosi is an actual socialist. I don't buy that Joe Biden is socialist. I don't buy that the only people that, there's four socialists.
Yeah, the only people that are socialists are the ones that say that they're socialists, Bernie Sanders, AOC, a number of others, but they're the ones that openly say, yeah, I do democratic socialism.
And on the opposite end, there is the DNC convention, where it's just total,
Orange man bad, orange racial, man bad, orange racial, man bad.
Race pandering, right. And just total identity politics, and just both messages are just so thin, and they're
messaging, honestly, every time I watch them, I'm just okay, you're dancing around the fact that you did terrible things in your past. And I'm speaking for both parties right now, for both candidates. You've done terrible things in your past that you cannot defend, and you've made promises that you did not keep, right? And nobody really likes you. If people vote for you, they're going to vote for you because they don't like the other person more.
It's the election of
this is true for both candidates.
Mitigating risk election.
Exactly.
But I think that's almost that, is damage control.
Right.
So I guess if you have another point to add to this, one thing about civility. Remember, as things get more heated in our in our political discourse, and there's more and more media that comes out that tells us how divided and how much the left and right hate each other. Remember, most people are voting for the other person because not because they like the other person, it's because they don't like the other guy more.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you should have some type of ideological hatred towards people who vote the opposite way.
Right.
And just don't let them grind you down. I think I'm worn out by watching the media coverage already of the election, and I just want to take a step back.
Same. but we're only ramping up, so we'll see.
We're only ramping up. I haven't
seen the debates yet.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Well, we'll see. Do you have anything else you want to end us off with anything?
No, man, just like, rate, review. We appreciate all the comments, all the, you know, and this is something that we don't always say on the podcast. So if you're listening and not watching, we do this every Thursday night, live stream on YouTube. Around like 9 to 10 o'clock, somewhere in between those 2 hours, is when we usually go live. So if you're bored on a Thursday night and you want to watch us live and see our beautiful faces, like, jump on. It's fun. People comment and stuff, and yeah, it's fun.
It's fun. Have a beer. And then if you're listening to it, rate and review the podcast on Apple, iTunes. Those ratings do help us grow, and it's much appreciated. And yeah, that's all I got to say.
All right. Peace.
Anything else? Peace.